Basically, we're out of money for the senior programs for the rest of this fiscal year.
The Bethel Senior Center slashes critical services. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 21st of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, BP shareholders sue company executives in Anchorage Superior Court.
It's a suit that says, hey, listen, you know, this company should be doing better.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska's senators split their votes last night on a financial reform bill that passed 59-39. Democrats largely supported it, and all but four Republicans were against it. The bill still has to be reconciled with the House version, so it's not done yet. As it stands, it would keep taxpayer dollars from paying for bank bailouts and start a consumer financial protection agency to help people caught up in bad loans and with complaints or concerns against banks. Unlike most bills that weaken as Congress negotiates compromises, Senate members say this legislation grew more layered because of public outcry over Wall Street's power. Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich voted for it. He says regulating banks needs to start somewhere.
It made more disclosure, made more responsibility, and giving consumers avenues for redress when they believe they've been wronged by a financial institution. So I was pleased with that because it finally went the right direction. Rather than watering something down, we strengthened it even more.
Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski voted against the bill, saying it will overregulate small banks and credit unions. She says it could go as far as to regulate orthodontists who let patients pay in installments. She calls it burdensome and says it creates a massive new Washington bureaucracy. The Eddie Hoffman Senior Center in Bethel means a lot of things to a lot of elders. It's food, transportation, and it's friendship. But starting Monday, these services are being dramatically cut back. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Bethel's tribe, Ugusagagamute Native Council, runs the Senior Center. They announced the cuts this week, which includes eliminating all daily lunches served at the center and limiting their delivered meals to 25 a day. Staff was informed about the cuts this week. The bus driver was laid off. All others have been put on part-time. Now more than ever, they will be relying on volunteers. Five volunteers in hair nets busily worked in the kitchen on Tuesday. They are supervised by one staff person in the kitchen, which serves up to 90 meals a day. One volunteer runs a big roll of plastic wrap, sealing up unfinished dishes for the elders to take home.
For some, it's the only meal they get.
Thelma Kaganik has been the director of the Senior Center for the last 2 years.
We were told yesterday that one elder has absolutely nothing, so he drinks Tang to put something in his stomach.
I save the meal for supper time because I couldn't go store.
71-year-old Liz Howard gets food delivered almost every day. She doesn't get to the senior center often because of a broken hip that still bothers her. She also broke her wrist a while back getting rainwater. But like most Yupik elders, she worries less about her own position and much more about others.
They have no money to get extras, and they need the food and everything. I hurt for them. I really hurt for them. Because they're my friends.
Besides cutting meal service, the Senior Center is eliminating its bus service altogether. That means no longer taking seniors to and from the Senior Center, nor on community outings to the hospital, post office, and bank. This will affect 85-year-old Maggie Hunt, who wears a handkerchief tied around her head and dark-tinted glasses.
I used to something like sewing or anything, clean up. Since my eyes are not good, I never do much things.
Hunt is from the Lower Yukon village of Kotlik, but she moved to Bethel to live with her daughter and be closer to the regional hospital. Besides the food and transportation she gets at the center, she perhaps enjoys the companionship the most. As translated by John Active.
She said she's very thankful for the senior center because she doesn't dwell on the loneliness of missing her friends and relatives or her son, because she gets to socialize.
Hunt also attends the center's adult day program, which helps special needs elders with everything from laundry to bathing to just hanging out. That program is being cut to just 3 days a week. The senior center's finances didn't just fall apart overnight. The center was first run by the city of Bethel for 20 years. Then in 2005, the tribe took it over. The city continued to support the program for a few years during transition. The tribe's executive director, John Gwynn.
Basically, we're out of money for the senior programs for the rest of this fiscal year.
Running the senior center cost about $543,000 last year. A lot of it went to operating and maintaining the 40-year-old building. To pay for services, the center receives about $190,000 in state grants and an additional $190,000 from local cash donations and fundraising efforts, including Rippy sales. Gwynn says this year has been particularly hard with unexpected expenses like freeze-ups at a few buildings. He says they need over $160,000 just to get to the end of June, but they don't have it.
For the remaining of the year, we have about $69,000, and about half of that, or a little over half of that, is tied up in a barge order that leaves us $31,000 to operate the whole facility for the rest of the year, and that is not going to cut it.
Gwynn says they will receive the same amount of state funding next fiscal year. They are also looking at securing federal tribal money. He says they are seeking help from local agencies as well as state and federal lawmakers. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
A 3-year-old girl was mauled to death by a dog in Nebuskiak. It happened Thursday evening. Alaska State Troopers responded to the village to investigate. They say 3-year-old Crystal Brink of Kasigluk was killed. She had been visiting family in Nebuskiak with her mother. She had wandered off and was missing for about an hour. At about 6 p.m., she was found in a dog yard where she had been killed by one of the dogs. Troopers say the dog was chained up. An upset family member of the girl shot all 7 dogs in the yard. The body of the girl was sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. Flooding has damaged some streets and power poles in the community of Buckland, southeast of Kotzebue. Darlene Hadley, acting city administrator, says the water came up earlier this week, starting on Sunday, when a jam on the Buckland River broke free.
The ice got stuck out front here for a while, and the river started rising. It went all the way up the front street. The roads got washed out to the airport. The roads got washed out to the city office. The roads got washed out to the uptown section. This past couple of days, the ice have moved down. I don't know how far. Just this morning, finally, the water receded about probably 5 feet.
No homes were flooded and no injuries have been reported, according to Hadley. She says river water is receding now, but another jam upriver could cause more flooding.
There's usually a jam up the bend, which is about maybe 1 mile up. It has an S-curve there, and the ice there usually gets stuck.
Northwest Arctic Bureau officials are in Buckland surveying the damage. Hadley says some icebergs got close to homes next to the river, and heavy equipment is being used to remove them. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the joys of literary expression.
About a boy who goes on this trip and has to fight the huge, like, hairy gorilla things.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
BP shareholders filed suit in Anchorage Superior Court yesterday, alleging serious mismanagement at the company has led to reckless environmental and safety practices. Attorney Patrick Coughlin with a law firm in San Diego is handling the case. He says the Gulf of Mexico oil spill is just the latest in a long line of disasters that includes the Prudhoe Bay spill in 2006.
It's a suit that says, hey, listen, you know, this company should be doing better.
Coughlin says the company has lost $50 billion in market value as a result of the Gulf spill.
A derivative action is mainly to set reforms to prevent like conduct happening again, you know, by the officers and directors. So it should be helpful to the corporation ultimately, and then in turn, of course, return shareholder value.
The law firm also filed a motion in Anchorage Superior Court yesterday accusing BP of failing to implement reforms that were required in a settlement after the Prudhoe Bay spill and the 2005 Texas City refinery explosion. Coughlin says the company was supposed to link executive pay to environmental and safety performance and increase the accountability of the BP board to shareholders. He says none of the reforms have been instituted.
All they've had is one disaster after another, and so they're basically at the top of the list as far as, you know, the worst record. You know, hopefully, you know, we'll, you know, get them back in court and try to bring them in personally to answer some of these questions.
Coughlin says he hopes the legal action gets the attention of BP's board of directors. BP did not respond to a request for comment. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke recently approved the Chinook Salmon Bycatch Plan proposed by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. The plan closes the pollock fishery if 47,000 king salmon are caught and places more stringent monitoring and controls on the fishery. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin in Nome has more.
A coalition of Western Alaska organizations had asked Secretary Locke to reject Amendment 91. The groups unanimously suggested a cap of 30,000 Chinook salmon. President of the Alaska Village Council Presidents, Myron Nanning, says the plan completely ignores the recommendations made by Western Alaska tribes and organizations.
It's unfortunate that he would support that because last summer, many of the fishermen on the Yukon did not get their subsistence catches, and when one area of the village was completely shut out for Chinook salmon, the federal and state law enforcement people were monitoring them so that they would pursue them with citations, and while they allowed thousands of salmon to be thrown overboard by the Bering Sea trawl fleet.
The plan came in response to a record amount of king salmon bycatch in 2007, when 120,000 king salmon were unintentionally caught and wasted in the pollock fishery. Deputy Regional Administrator for NOAA Fisheries in Alaska, Doug Meekum, says much of the focus is on the cap number, but the plan places more observers on fishing vessels. It also includes measures to count every Chinook salmon accidentally caught. The industry will also look more into which tributaries king salmon were destined.
That is, how many fish are going to the lower Yukon, or how many fish are going to Bristol Bay, or to Cook Inlet, or to British Columbia.
Meekum says NOAA used to get estimates, but they weren't very reliable.
The new program will allow us to have better estimates of catch, better estimates of stock composition than we've ever had before. And I think people should be heartened by that because, you know, we need to understand the implications on various stocks of harvest of bycatch in the pollock fishery.
Meekum also said since the 2007 numbers of Chinook bycatch, the behavior of the fishing fleet has changed. In the last 3 years, the total bycatch of Chinook salmon is less than 20,000, with 7,000 Chinook caught in the fishery this year. Southern Norton Sound Fisheries Advisory Committee Chairman Art Ivanoff says with Secretary Locke's recent approval, Alaska Native organizations need a seat at the table.
Their voice should be given more credence. And for the most part, this process has not really worked for the Native community.
Late last year, Ivanoff asked Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich for support in gaining seats on the Fishery Management Council, and both rejected his request. Ivanoff is also a fisherman from Unalakleet. The low returns of the prized and oily king salmon cause families to question the sustainability of the resource. The act of catching salmon and processing it not only fills freezers, but contributes to a level of wellness within the communities.
Looking at our stocks and the fact that we're looking at an escapement of 1,200 kings and we haven't been able to, you know, meet that escapement, I think is a real concern.
Alaska Native leaders have said by relying on industry incentive plans as the primary means of bycatch reduction, the council and NIMFs have once again allowed industry to self-regulate. The Chinook bycatch plan will go into effect January of 2011. NOAA's Doug Meekum says they are optimistic their innovative plan will work. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Unusually low water on the Copper River could be a factor as salmon move upstream. Upper River State Management biologist Mark Somerville says the Copper River is the lowest it's been in many years, and that could accelerate or slow fish movement.
The fish may move a little faster than usual up the river because there's less resistance, obviously, with less water. I have also heard other theories where there's, with low water, there's fewer eddies for the fish to take advantage of, and it may actually slow them down. So almost anybody's guess as to how it'll affect the fish.
Ice conditions have delayed setup of the state sonar counter on the lower Copper River, and that could postpone the first dip net opening at Chitna. Somerville says he needs to get some readings from the counter before he can open dip netting, as scheduled early next month.
If the deployment of the sonar is delayed a whole lot longer, then what will happen is I won't have any data to use for opening the Chitna dipnet fishery on the 3rd, and I may have to delay the opening by a few days.
The sonar had gone in as of yesterday, but was not yet operational. Somerville says the king and sockeye catches so far during the Copper River commercial fishery have been below projections. The Alaska Supreme Court has handed down a decision in a long-running dispute between the state and the owners of the riverboat Discovery in Fairbanks. The court says the Binkley family-owned company has to pay the state for operating a wharf on the Chena River, but not as much as the state wants it to. Department of Natural Resources Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Wynn Menefee, says the ruling affirms a state right.
There was a contention that because they owned the land, they had a riparian right to, as it says, wharf out or to have a dock out over the water without having any requirement to go through Department of Natural Resources for authorization. And this upheld the state's position, which says, in fact, that they are required to obtain authorization from the state.
Authorization means yearly lease payments to the state based on fair market value of the river space. The court struck down much costlier DNR prescribed payments based on the number of passengers a business serves, saying a head-based lease charge violates federal law. The Binkley family, which has operated on the Chena since the 1950s, has been battling the state over the lease for decades. Riverboat Discovery Company President Ryan Binkley says he's happy with the latest court decision.
We understand that we use a certain small portion of the river to operate, and we don't mind paying our fair share. In fact, years ago, we offered to pay DNR based on the fair market value of that portion, but they insisted on a head tax, and that disagreement is what led to this dispute. So, again, we're thrilled with the court's decision today.
Binkley says a third-party appraiser came up with a $1,000 annual payment approved in the Supreme Court decision.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community. Offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The state's efforts to boost markets for locally grown products include a program to get Alaska produce in schools. Governor Sean Parnell has signed into law a bill that would create a farm-to-school program to improve nutrition in elementary school student diets. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Alaska Grown logo may be going back to school. On May 4th, Governor Parnell signed into law a bill that mandates state agencies to find ways to get locally grown products into school cafeterias. The bill, sponsored by Representative Carl Gatto, provides some $181,000 for two positions, one full-time and one seasonal. Francie Havermeister is director of the State Division of Agriculture.
We are still fleshing out this program because this is very new to us. It would be created within the Division of Ag, and their main goal would be to increase procurement and use of Alaska-grown foods in the public schools, as well as some agriculture education. Included in this and important to Representative Gatto, I believe, was getting the kids onto the farms or possibly starting school farms.
The Alaska Farm to School program is modeled on similar programs in other states. It is aimed at improving nutrition in school children while helping them understand where their food comes from,
as well as educate the kids on healthy lifestyles and the benefits of buying and eating Alaska-grown, or growing their own for that matter.
Havermeister says the new law improves on a current law providing state-grown produce in schools. She says efforts to do so have not always been successful.
And one of the issues that we've come across, too, is now the majority of the schools that have access to local product want a product that has been value-added and processed. So instead of wanting a whole potato, they would like to get potatoes that are cut and ready to fry or ready to go in the oven for French fries. So these are all issues that we will have to address.
This week, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly approved funds to help construction of an agricultural foods processing center slated for Palmer. Havermeister says the farm-to-school project is not linked to the processing center, although if it is constructed, it could provide some solutions. The borough has $300,000 set aside for the design of the processing center. One aspect of the plan is to provide pre-cut and blanched Alaska potatoes ready for frying. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Preliminary results from spring standardized testing of Alaska school children are in, with mixed results. The State Department of Education released the statewide figures Tuesday, reporting gains in the number of students passing the reading, math, and science tests, but declines in writing. In an age of text messages and Twitter, the long-form story may be in danger of extinction. But at the Pacific Northern Academy in Anchorage, Sarah Mariner's fourth grade class loves writing, so much so they recently published a book of their own fiction stories. Mariner says the idea started as a simple project where she encouraged her students to write what they know.
But they wanted to get more fantastical. Those books that we read, the things that they like to talk about are very fantasy-oriented. And I realized that, okay, well, this is a genre I don't usually write about or have kids write about because it's pretty complex. It takes a lot of planning, and usually kids don't have that. I said, well, we're just going to go for it.
Mariner students write every day. She sometimes gives them a prompt to get them started. That was the case the day I visited. The setup was a wooded area where kids play was slated for a new road.
What you need to do is choose a side to support and write a letter to the newspaper stating what you think should happen and why. Okay? So you can take one side or the other.
They can also choose to write about something totally different. The key is to write every day for at least 10 minutes. Mariner says the fiction story project taught them a lot.
We learned about paragraphing with fiction, which is very different than nonfiction. We learned about good word choice and precise nouns and adjectives and that kind of thing. We learned about dialogue and how not to use too much, but it's always good in some places.
The students drew their own illustrations. Someone suggested they should record the stories, so they worked with a local recording studio, and each student told their tale into a microphone. Liam Alexoff is 10 and says he really likes to write. Fiction is his favorite.
All right, tell me about it.
It's about a skeleton that, three skeletons actually, that are, they're supposed to go out and try to scare these different animals. And their names are Scully, Bone, and Rib. And Bone and Rib are really successful in doing that. But Scully, he can never scare a pig, and so he gets really, really frustrated.
Why, you might ask, is a skeleton supposed to scare a pig?
It's just an idea that, like I said, fiction, you can write whatever you want to write about.
The story is called Haunted, Just Kidding.
As he continued onwards, Pig's looming house soon appeared. At least I have a plan, Scully thought. It was about 9 o'clock, Pig's bedtime. He crept through Pig's downstairs window that led to his bedroom. He saw Pig in bed reading, just as I hoped, Scully thought. Slowly, he tiptoed towards Pig's bed.
Arrgh!
Scully growled in Pig's face.
Alexandria, or Alex Thomas, is 9. She says she loves to read. She pages through their class book and gives me the setup to her story, entitled Running.
These two sisters who have to find their family because they were lost. It's somewhere here.
Chapter 1.
Roar!
A sound came from behind me. I was running from something, but I did not know what it was. No, I yelled. I woke up panting and was bathed in sweat.
10-year-old Silas Rainier admits he doesn't really like writing all that much. One of his buddies told me he has a weird way of seeking inspiration by laying backward and letting the blood rush to his head. But Silas says that may not have been for inspiration.
That was just a way of wasting time, probably.
His story is a classic boy adventure.
It's about a boy who goes on this trip and has to fight these, like, hairy gorilla things, and then and goes on this adventure.
Hairy gorilla things.
Mm-hmm. My writer's journal. Somewhere in here.
The book and accompanying CD were made available for all the families of the young authors. Teacher Sarah Mariner says although writing in her class is not unusual, taking a project this far was, and the results surprised her.
Everyone came out of here believing in themselves as a writer. And for me, that was my teachable moment to myself, you know, really going to this level.
But as with all writers, there are times when things just don't work out, as Liam Alexoff admits.
Sometimes I come up with really good ideas. I start writing, and then I just forget about it and never finish it at all.
Lots of writers do that.
Yeah.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.